That's something I find a lot of people wonder about, especially these days when finances are a lot tighter for many people. How do you go about starting a business when you don't have your own money to put into it and you're not sure how to approach other people? Why don't you, well, I guess we could start from there. You know, what was your experience like deciding to start something without any finances to throw into it?
Right on, man.
Hey, welcome to the Power Entrepreneurs Podcast. I'm Jake Rosenberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Jacob Busani, and this is the show for entrepreneurs and business owners to get a behind-the-scenes look at how the uber-successful around us think and operate.
He's the CEO of GreenPal, an online marketplace that connects homeowners with local lawn care service providers, called the Uber for Lawn Care by Entrepreneur Magazine. Before starting GreenPal, Brian Clayton founded Peachtree Inc., one of the largest landscaping companies in the state of Tennessee, growing it to over 125 employees and over $10 million a year in annual revenue until its acquisition by a national service provider. We're excited to talk today about entrepreneurship, startups, small business growth, and bootstrapping businesses from zero revenue to profitability with Brian Clayton here on the Power Entrepreneurs Podcast.
What was your first foray into entrepreneurship? And knowing that you didn't have anyone to back you up, you didn't have any of your own finances to back you up, how did you go about starting your own business?
Yes, so I was drug into entrepreneurship, kicking and screaming by my father. He forced me to mow my first yard when I was like 14 or 15 years old. He interrupted a day of playing Nintendo on a hot summer day and said, "Hey, we got a job to do. We're going to go mow the neighbor's yard." And he and I went next door and we cut the neighbor's grass, made like 20 bucks and we split it. And ever since then, I was just hooked on owning my own business, being an entrepreneur. I actually, by the end of that summer, had four or five people throughout the neighborhood I was cutting grass for. And I continued to do that through high school and college. And when I graduated college, I had to kind of figure out, okay, was I going to double down on my lawn mowing business or was I going to go into the job market? And I quickly figured out that I was going to take a big pay cut if I was going to go work for somebody. And so for me, I've just always loved being in business for myself and being an entrepreneur. And I grew that lawn mowing business into a real landscaping company, one of the largest in the state of Tennessee. Over 150 people, got it over $10 million a year in revenue. And in 2013, that company was acquired by one of the largest landscaping companies in the United States. And so going from just myself and a push mower to 150 people over a 15-year period of time, I learned a lot of lessons on how to build a business, how to grow a business, how to be a leader, how to be a good manager, and just all through trial and error, doing it the wrong way for way too long and then trying to figure out the right way to do it. And in those early days, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there wasn't a whole lot of podcasts like this. There wasn't a whole lot of people discussing these things, and there wasn't a way to access this information. Nowadays, you know, you can just listen to a podcast, go on YouTube, watch a class on Udemy or even Masterclass, and you can learn the skills on how to build a business the right way the first time. And so in many ways, I think it's easier to start a business than it's ever been. And so that's why I like sharing my experiences of how I built my first company and sold it. Now I'm working on a company called GreenPal, which is basically the Uber for lawn mowing. So if somebody needs to have their grass cut, they just jump on our mobile app or our website and they can get hooked up with a good lawn mowing service in less than a minute.
I love that. But going back to, you know, the early days, I find that one of the most difficult things for entrepreneurs is kind of separating that thing that they're good at doing. You know, the typical e-myth story of a woman starting a bake shop because she likes baking, but then you have to learn to run a business, which is a completely separate thing. What was that like for you? At what point did you realize that this isn't just about pushing a lawnmower around somebody's yard in the neighborhood, but, you know, how did you go about figuring out what you needed to do to turn that into an actual business that you can scale?
Yeah, great question. And you mentioned one of my favorite books, The E-Myth. That is like the holy Bible of starting a business and running a business. It is just the handbook for how you think about being on your business and not in your business. And so a lot of people, when they start a business, they've just basically created a job for themselves. So I love that book. I'm glad you mentioned it. You know, for me, business ownership is like the access to the American dream. It is the vehicle for social mobility in this country, and it still exists. One of my favorite shows about 10, 15 years ago was a show called Entourage. And in that, it was one scene in that show where Turtle, the little kind of, you know, short guy, wanted to start a limousine business. And he goes to Ari Gold, the successful hotshot agent, and he's like, Ari, I know you know some people with money. I just need some money to start my limousine business. And he says, okay, let me see your business plan. He goes, well, I don't have one yet, but I got it here. He goes, okay, well, how do you expect to return capital to myself or my investors? Well, I don't really know that yet. Well, how do you think about differentiating your limousine service against others that are already in LA right now? Well, I haven't really thought about that, but I just know it'll work, Ari. And he just basically rips him down and tears him apart in like less than 60 seconds. And then he's like, listen, the truth is it's really hard to make something of yourself, but you can do it with a business. And I just thought like that lesson that he taught Turtle, the character, in like less than a minute was just so true. And it was just like, it's just like my experience as a business owner. It has been the thing that's enabled me to make something of myself, but it's been hard. So like, how do you get started? You know, you make a plan, but you don't spend too much time planning. You know, you gotta figure out what are the one or two or three things that you can do this week to get yourself from here to here, and how do you get started? Because getting started is the hardest part. And then you might say, well, I don't have any access to capital. Well, most businesses don't really need that. Some do. You know, if you are thinking about starting like a scooter business or something like that, and you got to buy a bunch of scooters, then yeah, you're going to need to raise some capital. But most businesses don't. A lot of businesses, you can kind of hustle your way through the early days and literally like hustle on at nights and weekends and until you get enough money going to where you can reinvest it and grow it. So for me, like as a business owner, revenue is the best form of financing. I would rather be thinking about how I'm going to build a better product or service than my competitors than like going around trying to wine and dine investors. That's just my philosophy. I'm not saying it's the only path to success, but it's what's worked for me. So in my first business, my landscaping company, I literally would drive around mowing yards, and then I had a helper that I hired, and I would have him mow the grass, and I would be in the truck cold calling restaurants and business owners and apartment complex managers and things of that sort, trying to hustle up more business. And so for me, like sheer hustle and just like making some money, living on as little as you can and reinvesting that money to make more money is the recipe that has been like core to my success, starting and building and selling my first company. And now my second company, Green Pal, growing it to where we are today. That's been like instrumental and just like that hustle, just trying to figure out how you're going to make some money and reinvest that money to make more money.
I love that. And I also love that you brought up Entourage, which was great show. But if I remember correctly, also Turtle ended up getting very creative with how he was able to raise funds for starting his business and went a million different directions. But I think that testament to entrepreneurship is sometimes you need to get creative with how you're going to get your business off the ground. And so I'm kind of curious, kind of fast forwarding a little bit, once you grew the company, and as you mentioned, it was acquired by one of the biggest landscape companies in the country, which is an amazing feat. But I find that a lot of people have that as their goal from the get-go, and they're not sure how to get themselves to a place where they can even get that attention from a big company like that. What did you do to get their attention? Was that intentional? Did they just reach out to you at some point? How did that happen?
Yeah, great question. So there's a couple different schools of thought here. There's some entrepreneurs that will coach you on, okay, you have to start with an exit like day one, and you have to work backwards from that. Otherwise, you'll never get there, and you have to have that plan. And then there's other people that will say, on the other hand, if you're starting a business to sell it, you're never going to make it because it's just too damn hard. There's like a passion. There's like a irrational like fanaticism to getting one of these businesses to success. And so you almost have to like be driven in a weird way by something more or higher than just money. And so for me, I probably skew more towards the latter, because for me, I just wanted to have like the biggest, best landscaping company in the state of Tennessee. And like, for me, like my businesses have always been an extension of myself, like my pride, my ego, if I'm honest, my happiness is like an extension of how my business is doing. And so for my first company and now my second, growing them from scratch and seeing them prosper and then seeing like the people that work for me prosper was just a passion for me. And so that's what got me from like my first 10,000 in revenue to my first 100,000, my first million, first 5 million, then 10 million, was just that fanaticism to climb to the mountaintop is what got me there. I wasn't thinking about an exit the whole way through. So that's how I got from zero to one. Now, when it came time for me to sell that business, I realized, okay, I've taken this thing as far as I can. And now it's time for me to move on to my next idea. And it, now it's time for a bigger company to take what I've built and take it to the next level. When I made that decision, to the point I sold it was 2 years. And so I had to go back in and like reverse engineer a lot of systems and processes into the business that weren't there that a bigger company was going to need. And so it took a long time to do that. So if I had really thought about it and like built the business to be sold, I probably could have saved myself a lot of time and headache, but I just didn't. But paradoxically, if I had that when I first started, I probably never would have gotten there because I wouldn't have had the passion to get through the hard times. So it's nuanced. I think you have to have a little bit of both. A good book for me that helped me when I was going through the sale was a book called Built to Sell. And in that book, it's kind of like the E-Myth in a sense, but it is a manual on how to really think about building systems in your business so it can be acquired one day. Because that's one of the beauties of building a business is that you're building an asset that could be bought by somebody else. Whereas if you're self-employed, you just have bought yourself a job. So those are really two different kind of tracks. And there's nothing wrong with being self-employed. You don't have to like try to build some big business. But if that's the path you want to go down, you need to think it through. And you really ideally would be doing that along the way and not try to reverse engineer into it like I did.
I think that's such an important aspect because that's probably one of the key differentiators between what might be considered a mom and pop kind of show versus a business is systems that you have in place. And I think systems is generally what will get the business to a place where you can easily scale it, because at the end of the day, you need to be able to hand certain parts of the business over to other people. You need to be able to automate certain parts. There's only so much that we can do on our own as a business owner. So I'm curious what your process was like when you decided that you needed to systemize certain aspects of the business. How did you go about figuring out what was the most important part? How am I going to systemize this? Do I need to bring somebody in? What was that process like for you?
Yeah, it's hard. I think every business owner does it wrong. Well, I know I did for a very long time. And the E-Myth actually walks you through this step by step. If I had read that book in 1998 when I was starting my first company, I could have built it in half the time. But I didn't come across that book until it was like way down the path of my entrepreneurial journey. But in that book, they talk about, okay, it doesn't matter how simple your business is. And let's just use the pie shop, for example, which is the example they have in that book. You have to create an org chart for your business for all of the roles and processes and things that you do. So if it's a pie shop, it's like, okay, who handles the cash register? Who is baking the pies? Who is procuring the ingredients? Who is mopping the floor twice a day? Who is the person that is overseeing like how we're getting traffic into the storefront? Who is the person that is figuring out like the recipes that we're using and how we're differentiating our pies in the marketplace? Who is the person that is cleaning up all the pots and pans at the end of every night? And at the beginning, it's going to be your name on every single one of these roles. But as time goes on, you can then peel your name away from some of them and delegate them to helpers or subcontractors. And that's how you delegate from a position of stewardship. It's, or you're not delegating from what they call abdication. It's like, I don't want to do this. You handle it. It's stewardship. It's, I understand what this role is. I've done it myself. This is the process that we go through to accomplish the role. And this is actually a document that I'm going to give you, which educates you on how we do things here and what's expected of you. And so you have these roles and goals around every single function that your business has to accomplish in order to operate and be successful. And that's how you begin to codify, okay, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is why we do it. And this is how we do it different than our competitors. And this is how we then layer in team members to accomplish what it is we're trying to do. If you can think it through like that, rather than trying to be like a one-man army and do all these things yourself, which in the beginning you will, but a lot of times a business owner will just hire their first person, and then basically you got two of yourself, and it's everybody going crazy. When in fact, you need to figure out, okay, what are the things that I need to delegate from a stewardship standpoint, and ideally get somebody in those spots that's better at it than I am. And if you continue to do that, rinse and repeat, you'll wake up in a very different reality a year or two or three later than you were when you were just trying to hold it all together.
Mm, I love that. It's so true. And a great point that you made, which is to do it from a place of stewardship rather than a place of, I don't really want to do this, and just trying to offload whatever you're not in the mood of doing. But right. I'm kind of curious, you know, having gone through that whole process in your first business, sold the business, and then started on GreenPal, what did you notice was different in building GreenPal versus when you built your original landscaping company?
Man, that's a great question, because it was a painful experience. So building my first business was a traditional, like, hand-to-hand combat, brick and mortar, analog type of business. And we were really good at what we did. I had a great team, and I was good at it. And I got good at it over 15 years. And then I sold it, and I decided, okay, it's time to get back in the game, because I love entrepreneurship. I love running businesses. So I started seeing what Uber and Lyft were doing for ride sharing, and, you know, what Airbnb was doing for accommodations. I thought, okay, there needs to be a product, a platform, a marketplace that makes lawn mowing easier. I just saw how hard it was running my business for 15 years. It was hard to get started as a lawn mowing service. It was hard to grow your lawn mowing service. For a homeowner, it's hard for them to find good fits to come just basically cut the grass. There's no way for them to know who's good. There's no way for them to reach them. And so I knew that this product needed to exist, but I didn't understand how hard it was to build technology and how hard it was to distribute and market technology. And these were things that I was really naive about. And my two co-founders and I, we really thought we were just going to, like, pay somebody to build the first version, market it, and we would just be off to the races. We paid a development agency in Nashville $150,000 to build the first version of GreenPal. And we launched it. This was money that we kind of, like, cobbled together, and there was some on credit cards and lines of credit and savings. And it was just like every dime we could get together to build the first version. And we launched it, and it was a total flop, total failure. And the software was hard to use. It was confusing. It just didn't do a lot of the things it needed to do. And we were like, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? There's so much work that has to be done. So we at least have to be able to self-execute these things. And so we had to go back to the drawing board and teach ourselves how to write software, how to design software, how do you market software. And these were all skills that we had to learn and teach ourselves in the early days of building GreenPal that I did not anticipate. I thought I was going to be able to use the same tool set that I had building my first business, building the second business. But it was a completely different set of skills. And luckily, you know, I had two people that were just as fanatical about it as I was. And we would work 80, 90, 100-hour weeks we did in the first 3-4 years of this thing, working in the business, working on the business, but also, like, learning the skills that we had to learn to build, design, build, and scale and distribute software. So it was a really hard journey. I had to completely reinvent myself. And I coach and mentor entrepreneurs here in Nashville. And that's one thing I try to, like, get people to understand is, like, if you're going from an analog business to a strictly tech one, there's going to be a learning curve there that you're just going to have to grind your way through.
I think it's interesting, because we're seeing over the last couple of years, especially, how so many different businesses are finding a techie way of providing their service. And so when you go about developing a technical service, it's obviously going to be different. It's a whole different world. How did you go about deciding who to work with, number one, as your partners? Because I know that's a very difficult point for a lot of people, you know, the thought process of, if I want it done right, I need to do it myself, and partners are just going to distract or take away from my company. There's so many negative biases. So I would say, first off, in terms of partners, how did you choose your partners? And then second off, in terms of who to develop your system and your app and your, and the online system as well and all of that.
Yeah. Great questions there, because they're critical. If, you know, most businesses can be pulled off without a partner. So if you're going to start a restaurant or a construction company or a home cleaning service, or maybe you're a dentist in dental school and you want to own your own practice or something like that, most of the time you can do it solo. And that's what I encourage entrepreneurs to do, because the minute you introduce a co-founder or two, it, in a weird way, like, decreases your chances of ultimate success, because a lot of times the demise of businesses is fighting amongst the co-founders and animosity that brews between them, whether rational or irrational. And a lot of times that introduces more complexity into ultimate success than not. That said, if you're entering into a domain where there's just like so many different expertise you need to be bringing to the table in terms of, like, well, for example, a tech startup. Ideally, if you're going to start a tech startup, you would have two co-founders, a hacker and a hustler. So you would have somebody that can do the technology side and just grind their way through that. And you would have somebody that can make it rain in terms of getting sales, just hustling the ball forward. That's ideal. But a lot of times that doesn't come together. A lot of times there's two hackers that come together or two hustlers. In my case, I just flat out got lucky. I recruited two co-founders that I was lifelong friends with, that I knew were hard workers, that I knew that had a desire to, like, up to my earlier point, to make themselves. And I knew that if the three of us got in a room and stayed there for 10 years, that we'd figure it out. And that's how it worked for us. Now, we had to go back and learn how to write software and how to design software and how to do things like SEO. And, like, we had to learn all those things, and we were just flat out determined to do it. That doesn't happen very often. And so I kind of got lucky in a sense. And so I can't codify it and, like, dole it out as advice, but I can say that a lot of times when you're recruiting co-founders, you need to think of it as a marriage, because in a weird way, it's almost easier to unravel a traditional marriage than it is a business partnership. And in many cases, they last longer. And so if you are going to recruit a co-founder, think of it like a marriage. Think of it like, do I really enjoy working with this person? And can they complement my skills? Do they have something to bring to the table that I don't? And are they willing to, like, fanatically work as hard in this thing as I am? And if you can get that right, then it can be a fulcrum for you. And a lot of the great businesses you look at, whether it be Uber, Airbnb, I don't know, Lyft, like, you look at these businesses, they were founded by teams of complementary co-founders that worked well together. And if they were solo entrepreneurs, they probably would have never made it. So when it's done right, it's like one of the things that gets you across the finish line. But sadly, most of the time it's done wrong, and it's the reason why the business never takes off.
Mm. And then just to kind of feed off of that, in terms of, once you got that team together, I guess, the co-founders, and started the company and figured out exactly what it is you wanted to do and how you were going to move forward doing it, how did you go about deciding who to bring on to actually execute on the vision? You know, as you mentioned, tech is a very big thing to take on. It takes teams of people to actually put it together. How did you go forward finding the right team to work with?
Yeah. So in the early days, it was very just hands-on. What are the three things we can be working on right now to make some progress? And all the way down to, like, when we first launched that first version I was telling you about, we couldn't get any users to it. So we had to pass out door hangers all over Nashville, Tennessee, where we live. And that was the only way I knew to get people to try this software. We passed out 100,000 of these things. So you got three people that own, you know, that own this business, passing out door hangers. That's what we had to do that month to get people to try it. Then after we got a few hundred people to use it, then the three of us met with as many of them as we could and got feedback around, okay, this is the problem we're solving and this is where we're coming up short. And here's what they wish the product would do. And here's what we need to work on. And so like the three of us did that. And then we were able to understand, okay, well, this guy is a little bit better at engineering related stuff than I am. I'm a little more of a hustler type. I can like do sales, so that maybe I'll take care of that. And then this guy is good at like outreach to PR and media and design, so maybe he takes care of that. And so then we kind of like doled out the things that we need to do based off of our DNA, like our natural skill sets. And that was kind of a way to get us a little closer to something that might work. And then after that, it was like us three doing everything for 2 years. We didn't hire anybody to help us until we could afford to. And my two co-founders worked nights and weekends. They still kept their full-time job on this thing. And so we didn't really hire anybody to delegate anything until we could afford to do it off of the revenue the business was bringing in. As soon as we could, though, we had, you know, $5,000 a month total revenue. Now, you know, now we're going to do $20 million this year, but we had like $5,000 in total revenue that we could work with. And then we, you know, because we were doing this stuff ourselves, we could understand, okay, this is how you deploy that capital. And this is how we can delegate these sorts of things from a position of stewardship and not one of, I don't know how to code, somebody code. It's like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm not great at it, but I need somebody who's better at it than I am. And this is how I'm going to delegate it to them. And the good news is like these days, you know, you have access to a worldwide pool of talent if you're in the digital space. And so we were able to work with awesome developers all over the world that quite frankly, we don't have access to in Nashville. And that was one of the keys to success for us was taking the money that we were making.
Lost your audio.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you now. You're saying okay. The money you were making.
Yeah, so the money we were making, we were delegating to people who were much better at these individual skills than we were. And through a worldwide network of them as well, not just people in our own backyard in Nashville. And so that's one of the things that made this whole thing possible for us was the ability to make a little bit of money, delegate it to people who can help us make more money. And we wouldn't have known how to do that had we not self-executed these things for years ourselves.
I think it's pretty cool to see how, even though this was a tech startup, it is a tech company, you were still able to kind of go back to those old school roots of just getting in the dirt and figuring things out and then taking it from there and growing it and putting it towards the tech. Pretty cool to see. Also with something that you said, a little bit earlier in the conversation, which was, you know, in growing the company kind of the old school way, one of the things that drives you or drove you in the past was kind of that pride that you have in building the company up. And, you know, a lot of people look at entrepreneurs, I feel, and kind of see them as a bit egotistical in the way that they just feel they can take the world on and the way they push and drive forward. But I'm curious, kind of on the personal side of entrepreneurship, do you find that sometimes it's hard to balance out your ego when it comes to the business? And how do you approach that when you're in the moment and you're not sure if you're driving forward with ego or with what's best for the actual business?
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. You're exactly right. Like most successful entrepreneurs do have a bit of ego to them. But on the other hand, running and starting a business is one of the most like humbling things you'll ever do, because it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. You're subject to the feedback from the marketplace, and the marketplace is just a ruthless machine for feedback. So you kind of have to have an ego, and you kind of have to be fanatical to get to the top, but it's very humbling along the way. Like one of the things that happened to me was actually this year, I took a trip to Mexico, and on a whim, I decided to go climb a mountain. I didn't think this was a very tall mountain. I just booked it on an app called Get Your Guide. But in Mexico, you know, it's kind of like anything goes. And so I get there, and my Sherpa, my guide, is like, yeah, this is like the second highest mountain in North America. And I'm like, what? Yeah, it's 18,000 feet tall. And like Everest is like 26,000. So it's like, I'm not supposed to be there. I'd never climbed the mountain before. And so we get there, we take like a 4-hour drive, and we're at the base of this thing. I can't breathe. The air is so thin. And I'm following this guy up the hike at 1 o'clock in the morning, because we had to like leave at 1 o'clock in the morning to make it there by sunrise and then back. And I mean, it was like the hardest thing I've ever done. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, why the hell would anybody like want to do this? And like, he's just crushing it. And I'm like, and I'm observing him, and I'm like, this guy is an absolute fanatic about mountain climbing. Like, he is just like determined to get to the top of the mountain, and I'm following him. If he wasn't here, I'd be dead, and I certainly wouldn't have made it this far. And so I'm observing this guy, and I'm like, and in a weird way, I'm like drawing a parallel to like entrepreneurship. Like, if you're going to make it starting a business from scratch, it's going to be more than just trying to get rich quick. It's going to be more than like fulfilling some kind of ego thing. It's going to be like an obsession and like a fanaticism with inside of you to get there. And that's been my experiences, you know, building and selling my first business, now building my second one, is that you're driven by something that's more than money. Although, you know, money is part of it. But you're driven by something more than that. It's like, it's just a desire and obsession to win and to create something that is successful is what, for me, is like gotten me this far and what's going to see me through on this thing.
I think that's so important. And people don't think about that when they first get into entrepreneurship, because generally you get into it because you thought of something that you're good at or something you want to do. But these are lessons that we learn along the way. So speaking of lessons learned along the way, what are some, I guess, mishaps or mistakes that you've made in either of your businesses that you probably didn't think about on the onset that maybe people can learn from and avoid making those same mistakes?
Yeah, it's so many. Like, how do you pick? With my second business, Green Pal, one was coming to the table with a bunch of preconceived ideas and notions that I thought were to be truths based on my experience that I didn't validate. And I just set up upon a path, and I didn't validate these notions and these ideas. And so like the Lean Startup, that's all the Lean Startup book is about. It's about, okay, you've got these preconceived notions and ideas, but you need to validate them against user feedback. I didn't do any of that. And so that's what cost us like $120,000, $150,000 in the first year, was because we built that version of the service without getting any user feedback. So that's one like big mistake I made. Another mistake that I made was trying to build a product without just flat out following conventions and the successes of others that were in similar spaces. So for me, like, I thought that our product was going to be unique and that we would build it this certain way, when in fact, I probably should have been like following the conventions that other more well-funded companies that were doing. Like, for example, like in 2015, after we were just like not getting any traction with the product that we had in the hands of lawn mowing service providers, I decided like, okay, how the hell are some of these big players doing this? And so I signed up as a driver for Uber. I signed up for a driver for Postmates, DoorDash. I cleaned houses on HomeJoy. I walked dogs on Rover and Wag. I used every single like multi-sided marketplace that was operating in a similar fashion to ours that I could. And I took notes, and I did this for like 3 months. And I learned more doing that in terms of, okay, these are well-funded companies that are doing much better than we are. What can I learn from each of them and apply it to what we're doing? And that was like a vector like tilt for us. Like when I did that, you could just look on Google Analytics or whatever you're tracking, and you can just see, okay, this is when engagement went through the roof, because I was taking conventions and things that other smarter, more well-funded teams were doing and applying them to what we were doing. That was something I did wrong in the early days. I wish I had known to do that like day one. It would have saved us a year or two of doing things wrong.
I love that. I think if more people did what you did, they would probably get where they wanted to a lot faster. So with all of that, having gotten to where you are today and looking back, and also having mentored many people, as you mentioned, you mentor a lot of people out in Tennessee. When you look at entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship these days has become a very sexy term that everybody wants to be an entrepreneur and thinks that, you know, they'll just jump into it and do what they love and they'll make money and never have to work for anybody again. But what do you see differentiates what we would call a power entrepreneur from the average entrepreneur?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think the entrepreneur lifestyle or idea of it didn't get to be sexy until maybe you could probably map it back to the movie The Social Network. Like when that movie came out, it was the idea of starting your own business and becoming an entrepreneur was accessible and like appropriate for a wider like swath of people than never before. And so so maybe that moment in time has brought a lot of people into the game that didn't necessarily need to be. But the reality is that to start your own business, to become an entrepreneur, you're going to have to be a little crazy. You're going to have to like be a little irrational, and you're going to have to like think a little differently than most people think. And if you're not willing to do those things, you're probably not going to make it. And if you're trying to put, you know, entrepreneur in your Instagram bio and you tried to do this for 6 months or a year, you're going to learn really quick that it's not fun. And that the first, you know, like going from zero to one is hard as hell. And that you're not doing it for anybody other than your team and yourself. And so you're going to learn that quick regardless. If you're really doing this stuff, you know, one of my favorite quotes is by Charlie Munger. He's like Warren Buffett's right-hand man. And he says the first $100,000 is a bitch. And the first $100,000 in revenue is just really, 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 really hard. And the first million is just as hard. And so getting to those milestones is really what differentiates, you know, the wannabes and the ones that are really in it to win. And going back to my early point, I think it just requires like an irrational fanaticism that's beyond money to make it. And that's what brings you into the office on a Saturday. That's what brings you, you know, to your laptop on a Sunday afternoon. Like you are on this stuff 7 days a week, especially in the early days. And it's because you're driven by like something like greater than just making money.
I love that. So Brian, before we wrap this up, why don't you tell people how they can find GreenPal, how they can utilize it, and if they want to get in touch with you for mentoring or whatever it may be, how they can find you as well.
Yeah. So anybody that doesn't want to waste time cutting their own grass, they can just use GreenPal. You can download it in the App Store or the Play Store. You'll get hooked up with a good lawn mowing service in less than a minute. Anybody that wants to get at me, actually email is the best way. Brian, Bryan, at yourgreenpal.com. Just shoot me an email. I love just rapping about business and entrepreneurship. If you do, just try to put me on second or third base with whatever your question is. That way I can help you and help me help you. And I'd be happy to speak with anybody.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Hey, you powerhouse, you made it to the end of the episode. Not everyone can do that. We really appreciate you listening to our show every week. If you enjoyed this episode, let us know. You can find us on social media by looking for The Power Entrepreneur. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, even Twitter. Look for The Power Entrepreneur or go to our website, thepowerentrepreneur.com. If you really, really love the podcast, I'd highly appreciate it if you went on iTunes right now and left us a review. It helps us way more than you know. Go out there and make it a powerful life.